I Love Rock and Roll, Don't Stop Believing, or Living on a Prayer? Which 80s classic is the best 80s classic?
That is a good question. I can give you a very, very quick answer on this, though, because it happened to be my high school class song, and it is 100% Bon Jovi, Living on a Prayer.
Are you, like, old or something?
Like, nope, just that
how
was...
How did that end up being...
My senior class, like, no joke, our class song was Living on a Prayer, because no matter where it was, when it came on, we would belt it like none other.
Well, now I wish I went to your high school, because I'm pretty sure mine was just some dumb pop song, and I don't even remember, because it was some dumb pop song. Which is really unfortunate. To be a part of a class that thought the 80s were cool.
I mean, we didn't think all the 80s were cool. There were just bits and pieces that we decided
well,
to like.
I mean, yeah, naturally, because all the 80s weren't cool, but...
What about you, good sir?
Oh, that's the hard part. I picked a question that's going to kick my own butt this week. I think... I really enjoy singing Don't Stop Believin', because, well, who doesn't? But I think I have to land on I Love Rock and Roll, because it's the song that got me into all of classic rock.
Okay.
Like, that was like my gateway song, my gateway drug into the loveliness that is classic rock. Because of course I'd heard, like, all of those songs before. But I was at my cousin Liz's wedding, and that song, they played, like, everything from 70s and 80s rock. So okay. It was like, what is now my era, right? And something about hearing I Love Rock and Roll in that context, because it was just a great wedding, had me just hooked after that, right? Like, very shortly after that, I talked my mom into taking me somewhere so I could buy a Joan Jett album, like a greatest hits album.
Nice.
And then it was just like, oh, the whole world opened up to me from there.
See, I'm trying to think of where it was for me. Because, I mean, I came to rock and roll late because if we haven't covered this on the podcast yet, this might be a bit of an exclusive. When I was about 8 or 9, my household went to a completely Christian music only environment. And not even like oldies and things weren't really even played on the radio. So it wasn't until I was driving when I was like 16 that I even started listening to the classic rock station out of Rockford. So, I'm trying to think where it was, because my musical taste was all over the place because CCM screwed me up and I did not know where I wanted to be. And for the longest time, even when I was gigging out playing guitar, I'd fallen into this love affair with neoclassical guitar. So folks like Paul Gilbert and Steve Vai and Joe Satriani, who are just playing these just ripping solos speedier than all you can ever think. And I really wanted to be able to do that, so I tried really hard to get there, but it just wasn't my thing. But I'm trying to think who it was. I mean, Petty is real high on that list. Like, Free Fallin' was one of the first albums, or one of the first songs that caught me. But I really do think it was Skynyrd. I think Freebird had quite the effect on me, and then Sweet Home Alabama, and then though I will say my favorite song by them of all time is The Ballad of Curtis Lowe. And that's where my love of the dobro started.
Sure.
And slide guitar, and so I just have a special dobro music. Slide guitar has this special place in my heart, and I've nearly bought a dobro like 5 different times. Like, I've had the money in hand or in the bank account and been like, I want to do this, but I just couldn't. I walked away multiple times. So I was like, I just could not justify it.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. Good stuff.
It is good stuff. Speaking
of actually, as a completely random side note, it was really cool because when I went to go see Fleetwood Mac a few weeks ago, when they came back on for the encore, just kind of completely out of nowhere, the first song of the encore, they did Free Fallin', and they had like all these pictures of the band with Tom Petty, and it was this really cool tribute, and they didn't really even say anything, but they didn't have to say anything, so that was super awesome. I really enjoyed that. Yeah, and it was kind of one of those moments of like really hitting me that he's not around anymore, you know? So, but anyway.
Yeah, I've been going through, I've been on a bit of a blues jazz kick the past couple of weeks. Like, I was chatting with our buddy Graham over here, and like he's played all a variety of different types of stuff, but he never really got into like good blues, like 12 bar, 16 bar blues. And so I went to one of the people, like, we were just rolling through different music on our way back from we were on our way back from a shoot in Glasgow, and I pulled up Stevie Ray Vaughan, and he'd never really spent the time to understand Stevie Ray, and I was just like, and so immediately Pride and Joy goes on, and what is it, Texas, not the Texas Shuffle, that's the wrong one, but look up Stevie Ray Vaughan Texas, you'll be able to pull it up. And so I just started walking him through just the essential Stevie Ray, and since then it's been kind of on a kick. And so then last weekend, we went down to the university to see what we thought was going to be one of Ashley's professor's bands, but it was a band that he originally was a founding member of, and it's like a staff band, so it's members of the professorial staff playing things. It gets way better. So with their shtick of closing their act is they always do a vote, and so they would go to like the student union and then ask, okay, what song's hot right now, and they played it, and so they completely led up to this thing like, we spent the entire week learning chords we never knew existed and trying to memorize lyrics for something we never thought we would ever in a million years have to memorize lyrics to. And the song that comes on is Africa by Toto. And what's funny is they actually kill it.
Yes!
Like,
that's amazing.
At one point, like, the lead singer dropped his lyrics as he had them printed in front of him, and somebody else goes to get it. And he just, like, fans him away, and then just, like, goes hard into the chorus, like, as hard as he can.
Nice.
And so it was just like, what? Why is Africa so big again? Like, I like the song, but why? Why is it back again?
Because the internet, and for some reason, just like with everything else, like my sister and I were out somewhere. Oh, we were looking. So yesterday was our parents' anniversary, so we were looking at anniversary cards. And my sister was like, why does everything have cats on it now? And I was like, well, because the internet. Like, there is no logical explanation outside of the fact that the internet happened.
Yeah, I know Weird Al had a bit of a hand in the Africa.
Really?
I totally just realized that I was writing out the show notes, and I totally wrote Toto by Africa. that's totally not right.
Other way around. Other way around.
No, Weird Al did a cover of Toto, or gosh darn it, did a cover of Africa with Weezer for his album, and it's brilliant. I'll link it in the show notes. But I think that's part of the reason why it's come back around recently. It's pretty
interesting.
It's something special because he goes all Weird Al, elbows and knees halfway through, and the solo in the middle of it is completely synth accordion. And so it's something pretty special.
I think I'm going to have to call my friend Kevin after we're done here.
Yeah, you need to look
that
up.
This is something he and I need to discuss.
Yes, it is quite spectacular. But speaking of things we need to discuss, hi everyone, this is episode 85 of the MinMax podcast, and you will note two things. One, you will note that my normally marvelous tenor is slightly scratchy today, and that is because I have been ill this week, so I am doing my best to not make your eyes water with my throat sounding dry.
Ooh,
but as bad as I sound, sickness. I actually feel fine. It's just the last probably 36 hours or so, it's my body's just trying to get everything out of my system, so my throat is just a little bit sore. But beyond that, it is just fine. The second thing, and it is boo-worthy, is sadly, Ashley has gotten busy with school again, so for the next couple of weeks, it is going to be the Kyle and Alan show again. We might have a couple of guests here and there, but for now, it is you are left with the two of us. So as we discuss our topic, you'll get to listen to Kyle's sultry tones and my gravelly tenor.
Ah, yes. Sad day. Very sad day. We've lost another host. I just want to reincarnate her every single time that she has to leave temporarily and come back, just to see how many Ashleys we can accrue. Like, I'm just going to start calling her Ashley 3 now when she comes back. Or it's Ashley cubed.
Paging Ashley 3, other. Paging Ashley 3.
Just because, why not?
Well, Kyle, do you want to tee us off on our topic?
Oh, I suppose. I can take that job. So, in continuing with our fantasy series here, we were kind of thinking that one of the natural segues, you know, when we talked about world building last week, was to talk about some of the other things that fill those worlds, most particularly magical creatures, and things of that kind of mythicalness. I don't need to explain that further. Mythical creatures should be pretty straightforward. Anyway, so yeah, mythical creatures, Alan. Why in the world do we find it necessary to fill our universes with all these crazy, nonsensical critters? Tell me. I need to know.
Well, that is a very good question, Kyle. And I think, to kind of spin back on one of the things we've been talking about the past couple of weeks, one of the places that I tend to go is if, like, the normal flora and fauna of Earth are lovely things, but if we're going into a completely different setting, while some of those things existing is definitely a nice thing, if we're going to create a completely different world, though, and try to create a little bit of separation from the reality in which we live, I think we have to fill the space with things that are similar to things that we know, but slightly different as well. And I think when you add in mythical creatures. Now I will. I'm actually going to spin back on you here real quick. When you say mythical creatures, can you define that term for me?
Ah, there is a good question. So, because I'm actually spinning back on myself too as you're starting to talk, because I suppose we could differentiate between magical sentient creatures for one thing, and then magical non-sentient creatures is another thing. Because we can talk about magical, you know, to put it in D&D terms, like magical races or other, you know, humanoid races, dwarves, elves, goblins, so on and so forth. And then you've got the non-sentience with things like, I almost said centaurs, but I was like, nope, those are typically sentient. like griffins or hydras or dragons, or, well, no, dragons are usually sentient too. Good grief.
It depends on what universe you're in. Because that's actually, like, I can point to three different examples where you have sentient and non-sentient dragons. So, or at least a play on dragon, which we will inevitably end up in the Rothfussian universe. As per all of our discussions of fantasy, because y'all know all of him. So we'll end up at the Dracus at some point, but we will take this moment to step back from the dragon and the Dracus and move back to the previous idea of sentient versus non-sentient.
Right, because, you know, us staying on track is something that we're totally good at.
We might have new listeners. They don't know this, Kyle. Do not ruin it. Don't ruin it, Kyle.
I didn't say anything. You said something. Anyway.
Your mom said something.
So, define... Really? Your wife is gone for 5 minutes, and this is what we devolve into.
I mean, what else is new?
Fair enough. Oh, man.
So
all right.
Define mythical creatures.
Well, let's pick this apart on both ends of that spectrum.
Sure.
And see if there isn't anything else. Like, do we need to subdivide this further? Because, you know, is there a different purpose in having sentient non-human creatures than there is to having non-sentient magical creatures in the universe? So, like, here's an interesting thing, right? So I was going through, I was sorting a bunch of my minis today,
uh-huh.
Because I'm obsessed as a DM and I'm running a game and whatnot, and now I'm like, hey, I need all the things. So as I was sorting through them, I started looking at the minis for humans and for elves, and I was like, but like in mini form, you really can't tell the difference, because the only like really noticeable difference is their ears for the most part, especially when you're talking about minis. Like, they're just not, they're detailed, but they're not that detailed.
It's human, but with slightly bigger ears.
Right. And, you know, we could talk about culture and those kinds of things that is often very different in some ways. But I ended up just like creating a place in my box where I'm like, okay, this is just going to be the humans slash elves pile, because I can just use them for both. Like, why kind of shoot myself in the foot as far as the number of minis I have and what I want to use them for? So if we start with elves, and we could talk about dwarves too, because dwarves, again, aside from some specific cultural things, like, are they really that different? Or even hobbits. Or halflings, depending on, you know, which universe we're talking about.
Uh-huh.
Like, what is the point of all of these other very close to being human races existing?
Oh, you're asking.
That wasn't a rhetorical question.
No, I thought you were asking rhetorically.
Nope.
I mean, that's a good question. I mean, I think to me, the differentiation between those is... I mean, it's honestly to fill the world with people that don't look like us. And I think it's sure. to intentionally create divisions and different cultures. And not just different cultures in different places of a planet, but a completely different and completely alien to us. And I think that's why we do that, because we, by introducing something alien to our normal experience, by introducing something alien to the normal experience of a generally normal world, you create the opportunity to explore, kind of like we were talking about a couple of weeks ago, explore different aspects and different areas of, I guess, not human psyche, but of our kind of checkered history and prejudices, I think.
Sure.
And I think that's something that we do without really thinking. It's just we inevitably end up at that place where we start exploring the differences between ourselves and the differences, and introducing the idea of the other and what does this other thing do differently than we do that makes them different than us, or makes them better or more barbaric or scary to us, even though they might not necessarily be scary.
Right. It's interesting, because as you started talking, a question popped into my head that I was genuinely going to ask, and I'm like, Ashley's gone, so it's my turn to play devil's advocate. But then I realized, wait, no, that's not actually a question. I get it. Because I'm thinking, you know, my question was, well, are they really that different? You know, like, is an elf really that alien, to use your word, to our experience? And in some ways, yes, but also I'm like, well, but like, not really, right? Like, there are certain people who have similar philosophies. And then as I'm thinking through it, I'm kind of like, well, isn't that the point, though? Like, you're talking about the other, and isn't kind of the point of experiencing or encountering the other to realize that they're not that different in the end?
Yeah. They might be slightly so different in certain ways, but at the end of the day, it's pretty dang similar.
Right. And that was interesting, just to watch my own thought process kind of unravel itself as you were talking, just in terms of like, oh, right, but that's exactly it. If we can create those separations of reflection on, you know, certain, as you were talking about, specific traits, like, you know, those barbaric Goliaths or, you know, whatever, and then learn to find those points of contact with that other group, you start to develop that a better sense of your own place in the world, and it shines a light on those prejudices and things like that.
Yeah. But, I mean, this is if we're going pretty hard into the sentient side of things, though.
Right,
in this route. I kind of want to steer back to the non, or at least to away from the humanoid form, I think.
Right.
I think for me, it's not easy, but it's a more simple conversation if we stick to humanoid forms.
Oh, because, absolutely.
I mean, it's all like derivations upon the culture that we already understand.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that's why I wanted to start there, because I knew it wouldn't last long.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
it,
yeah.
You know, we can pick right through it. But, yeah, I am interested in this other side, too, because I'm thinking, you know, dragons are very different. Or, actually, one of the guys that's in the group that I'm starting a game for this weekend is playing a bugbear. And I'm like, oh, that's going to be new and different and fun. So, yeah, I don't know. What do you think there? What do we do with those far less human-y types of sentient creatures?
Well, I guess we still have to go back to our definition of like what primarily is the difference between mystical with sentience and mystical without. Like some of them are like if you think sentient creatures, you think things like centaurs, and you think like centaurs, minotaurs, dragons. I mean, you might even be able to make the argument for Monty Python's bunny that being an evil sentient creature.
You might.
And then you have things that just happen to fill the world, because depending on which canon that you're in, unicorns sometimes are mystical but not mythical, in that they exist in the world and they have magical healing properties but are not necessarily sentient. It depends on which canon you're going off of there. Because in the Harry Potter canon, if my memory is correct, they aren't sentient. They just possess mystical powers, and there's like it blurs the line between whether or not they're sentient or not, because the unicorn gives up its tears. So that that's I think there's an interesting line to be drawn there. What do you think on it?
Yeah, it's a good question, because, you know, I think those elements of sentience, even for creatures that are not meant to be, I mean, I think that validates real world experience too, because what about like I've noticed if I get irritated about something, my dog will like immediately jump up and come over to me, right? Like she's not super emotionally aware, but she'll do like little things like that, kind of, you know, play into that. So it's interesting, I think, to have those aspects of even non-sentient creatures, because it's true to our experience of the world, is animals still have some sort of awareness of what's going on around them. And we could really dive into this too deep and get into, you know, go back to the artificial intelligence thing and talk about where do we draw that line for sentience even.
Yeah. Is it something that you have? They have to be able to speak and like common or whatever
right. The
language happens to be, or if they possess their own language, or like mm-hmm. how intelligent is sentient? Because I mean, birds and deer communicate by grunts and squawks that they understand what's going on, and mm-hmm. like schools of fish have ways that they react, and then when the scout fish essentially says, hey, there's something wrong, the whole school will start swarming to try to protect
right.
themselves. And like it's, but that's, we wouldn't technically refer to them as sentient. They might just have some smart survival instincts.
Right, right. Well, and it's, you know, I think about that when I'm like building encounters or looking at creatures in the monster manual sometimes, and I look at their intelligence scores and I'm like, like, there's just a part of me that wants them to be super intelligent, or like using like speak with animals or something like that, right? And you're like, how do I really play this off based on their intelligence score? Like, is a relatively intelligent creature, if you're speaking to that creature using a spell or whatever, you know, like how how much more capable are they of creating complex thoughts in that case? You know, like the whole thing with Speak with Animals is like animals aren't capable of you know, creating complex thoughts. But it's like, but if you have an intelligence score of like 8 or 9, like you're not an idiot.
Language.
Right. So it's like, I mean, sure. Like I wouldn't expect, like, I think elephants have a pretty high intelligence score. And it's like, well, you wouldn't expect an elephant to talk. Well, sure, but maybe that's just because they don't have the ability to, you know, like the physical ability to. But if you are given some sort of magical ability, like how much is that elephant able to learn in that context? Mm. Or even, you know, something a little closer in terms of well, evolution being the best description of the word, but we won't go there. like various monkeys and their ability to like learn sign language and things like that, right? So it's a blurry line, I think, in the end, when we're talking about sentience versus non-sentience.
Yeah, I don't know that there's a good clean way to answer it one way or the other.
Right.
But for the sake of argument, let's move on to. I want to move to dragons because I think there is so, like, if you pick one animal that is, or one mythical creature, I mean, there are examples of it in almost every history of every civilization in the States, or mm-hmm. in the States, in the world. Mm-hmm. Like, some, they all have some different forms of dragon. And I think it's, whether that's small, like Mushu from Mulan, or whether that's, like, your D&D... just massive,
ancient red,
maniacal, ancient black dragon. Like you have examples that are similar to that, and or you have the more tricksy dragons that are trying to do things, like Smaug, who is gathering his own horde, and then you have less intelligent versions, like to mention again, the Dracus, who is an herbivore. Who just happens to secrete flame,
right?
And so we've got a wide spectrum to kind of analyze there. So let's, Kyle, I'm going to spin it back to you. Let's begin to pick this thing apart. Like where would you start if you were talking about why you think mythical creatures like this have such a history and why we always keep coming back to them?
Oh, man. Ugh, that's not the question I thought you were going
to
ask.
Oh, well, which question did you think I was going to ask? Like, feel free to...
Well, no, you teed us up to talk about dragons, and I was, like, starting to think through dragons, and then you just, like, hard left and, like, go general.
Then go straight to dragons. I'm totally fine being more specific on this.
I mean, I'm good with either way. I just wasn't expecting it.
gotcha.
Dragons might help tease everything else apart anyway. I wonder, with dragons specifically, there's something about, if you're talking about something that is that foreign and that, you know, terrifying in the sense of this is something that is huge, that would overpower me in an instant, that would just eat me with one quick snap of its jaws, like there's a certain degree of terror in that, right? In the same way that you'd be terrified if you ran into a grizzly bear. And yet, I wonder if there isn't an extra layer of terror added to that by the fact that they can then talk to you.
Yeah.
You know, like, if you have a creature that can sit there and, like, taunt you before it eats you... Like, okay, all right, right on. I mean, it's one of the things that makes the initial conversations between Bilbo and Smaug so interesting is he just, you know, Bilbo's invincible, or invisible, and Smaug's like, well, I know you're here, I can smell you, and now I'm going to sit here and just have this odd discourse with you, like to have something that's so sort of intelligent and so frequently wise in so many instances, you know, and then to have them also turn around and have no qualms about just consuming you. It, like, there's just something about that is really compelling, I think.
Yeah, it's... And that's, I mean, literally speaking, I mean, if we're talking about, like, actual talking dragons. I mean, it's hard to go anywhere but Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit for it. I mean, if we go in D&D land, I mean, insert good DM making a dragon talk. Like, we can easily go down the route of Mercer and his differentiation between chromatic and metallic, or metallic dragons and just regular chromatic dragons. They do provide an interesting backdrop because of some of the things that you were saying, that they are so intimidating, and yet they toy with you or they negotiate with you. And there's moments where you think, I might get out of this alive. And then all they have to do is huff wrong, and you end up on fire and smoking and half dead.
Right. Yeah. Oh, I had a thought and I lost it somewhere along the line. Hold on. It'll come back to me. Well, let's just spin off in that other direction and then go back to the question you actually asked instead of the one I was anticipating. Because this is something that I have become super fascinated with, and it's a driving force behind my desire to start studying folklore, is that question of, like, where do these things come from and why do they exist? Because almost everything, and I mean almost everything, especially all the classics, as far as like mythical creatures are concerned, come from some place in world mythology.
Yep.
Right. You look at, you know, all those classic creatures, like, I think the Phoenix falls into this category. I'm not 100% certain, but I know like griffins and, Gorgons, although I really have an issue with that differentiation that D&D does with Gorgons and Medusas.
Okay.
So I'm like, but it is a Medusa. It's not a Gorgon, whatever. Anyway. But, you know, those, we can trace all those back to Greek and Roman mythology. You can trace a lot of fairies and goblinoid type creatures to Celtic mythology, genies and djinn and I mean, all kinds of other, that spirals off into a whole subset of creatures itself, come from more of a, like a Persian Arabic, you know, mythology. And you just, like, you can keep going deeper and you'll find, like, you could sort through the monster manual and a significant number of those creatures come from somewhere in the world, from some mythological tradition.
Yeah.
And I think that's, there's so many different ways, and my brain's already buzzing in three different directions, that you can kind of take that, because on the one hand, we can talk about cultural appropriation and all that stuff, which is a whole side topic, but I really am fascinated by the question of, like, where do these things come from, right? So just to give you an example, because this is the first place I've really started to dig into as far as folklore is concerned, but Orcadian mythology, which comes from the Orkney Islands, which are just north of Scotland, right? And they have, and I'm such a nerd for being excited about this, but they have like four or five, maybe six different varieties of water horse demons. And yes, it is that specific.
Okay.
And I'm sitting here digging through folklore, trying to figure out, like, are these all each like separate creatures in and of themselves? Are they just like different names for essentially the same thing? But there's like very, and this is what, you know, this is what folklorists do. So I'm reading these folklorists who have studied Orcadian mythology, and they're parsing out those same questions of like, well, are they different? Well, you know, oftentimes when it's this creature, it's described in this way. But if it's this creature, it lacks all of those specific traits. So, you know, they must be different things. And so, you know, I sit here as somebody who has, you know, that slight backdrop in psychology and wonder, like, where do these things come from?
Uh-huh.
Because it's always about, you know, the guy who's walking home late at night and he sees the thing, right? Like, there is the thing. And he's terrified of it. So he runs and then he sees like this crazy thing happen, right? It's the tall tale. It's the thing that you go and it's that old guy who's sitting at the bar who's like constantly telling you stories that you're like, ah, whatever, dude. And yet those stories have created these crazy mythological traditions all over the world.
Uh-huh.
And And it's, I don't know how to quantify that, I think, because there's like, and here's where I struggle. Sorry, I'm talking a lot.
No, you're good.
But my brain is coming unraveled. Here's where I struggle because, you know, my kind of modernist type thinking, very logical scientific approach would be, well, you just saw things, you know, like it was just whatever. You saw a horse and now you're thinking it's a water demon horse because your imagination's getting away with you kind of thing. But at the same time, I'm like, but no. And I don't want to just project back on those traditions and say something about, you know, well, if you were just more scientifically minded or if you were just logical about it, you wouldn't believe those things, right? Because that doesn't do...
It's easy to try to look backwards in history and go, well, you just didn't fully understand. And
right.
Shame on you. And if you would have had a flashlight, you would have understood.
Right, right. And it's, and I think, I don't know, I think that's, I not only do I believe it's a poor way of thinking to think that way, I also am inclined to say that it's not true. It's not true to human experience. It's not true to the realities of the world. And I'm not, you know, necessarily suggesting that there are, in fact, fairies running around out there somewhere. But I'm not suggesting that there's not either. You know what I mean? Like, I just like to let that sit because I think it's important for those things to just be. You know, I think it's important to validate the experience of those stories in a lot of ways.
I mean, I get that to some extent. I mean, I'm not so sure I'm going to go so far as to say, especially in the land of the Fae, where there are fairies about doing things. I may not necessarily go there, but at least from a fantastical standpoint. To go back to more the fantasy side of things, when we start thinking about these things, one of the quick things that that novels and fantasy worlds always do is they always try to set up the boogeyman. Like there's no matter where you're at, there's always something, whether that's a goblin raid, whether that is like in Roth's world, there's so many different types. There's the Shambleman, there's the Chandrian, there's the spooks in the night that try to jump out and get you. In Lord of the Rings, there's the orcs, there's the ringwraiths that are things that people have heard of and they whisper about in the dark of night, but until they appear, people don't actually believe they exist.
Right. Which is very true of the Chandrian, especially.
Exactly.
Rothfuss, yeah.
Have you gone back and started reading again, or are you still in your limbo state?
I have done nothing but prepare for this Ravnica campaign. Like, I've set aside all my folklore research. Like, all I've been doing in my free time for the last, like, 3 weeks is reading Magic the Gathering lore. So,
okay.
Here's hoping it plays off well when that starts up, which... again, will happen. I'm not even going to talk about it. It's a complex, wibbly-wobbly, timey-wimey nonsense.
It's an already not yet
at this
thing.
Point. Yeah, right. Yes! Magic the Gathering eschatology jokes.
I mean, my bad pun's got to be good for something.
Yeah. Oh, man. Well... so let's maybe step back and take a different direction with this.
Okay.
What are some of your favorite mythical creatures and in what universe? Since we keep making the sure. clarification of, you know, it depends on which system you're talking about, which is true. What are your favorites? What do you gravitate towards the most?
That's a good question. And it's an interesting one, too, for me, because a lot of the fantasy universes that I love are ones that are already quite fantastical in nature already. So, like, I think of
sure.
Redwall, and that everything is already anthropomorphized animals. So,
right.
It's hard to go much further there, and they really don't go any further than that. Like,
sure.
it's just animals that exist. That is as mythical as it ever gets.
Sure.
So, like, I've got an affection there. I think about Harry Potter, I think about the small introduction that we get to the centaurs. Like, I remember in Goblet of Fire, right? When they meet, or was that earlier than that?
No, well, I mean, you get them right away in Sorcerer's Stone because you have the whole encounter with the unicorn,
yes,
and Harry gets rescued by the centaurs, and yeah, but it gets fleshed out much more. They might come up in Goblet of Fire
I was thinking of the Sorcerer's Stone. Encounter.
But they definitely come back up with Umbridge in Order of the Phoenix,
yeah,
too.
Because
that's kind
of
Umbridge's downfall. Yep.
Yeah, I think that, like, being introduced to that world and that kind of subculture, or culture, to use proper terminology, so I don't get people yet shouting at me about using the wrong terminology. That was really interesting. I mean, to go to one of my favorite books of all time, I mean, Shai Hulud is definitely one of those very interesting creatures, aka the worms from Dune.
Oh, okay, gotcha. I was lost.
Shai Hulud is the Arrakis native name for the giant sandworms, because they think they are gods, and so Shai Hulud be with you. So those are always really interesting. Like, I'm trying to avoid going to Name of the Wind, because it's just so easy for me to go there, because
sure.
It's the one, because
right.
I mean, I'm listening, we have the audiobook, and so I've got two different bookmarks, and so we listen to it as we're going to bed, because it's something familiar enough that we can just fall asleep to. So we're going through it there, and I'm listening to it again just because, and I'm also working through the 10th anniversary book. So, like,
right.
I am, like, pretty just completely immersed within that universe lately, and I'm completely happy with it. It's like, everything about it is fantastic. So I'm trying to avoid going there. In there, though, I mean, if I mention it, I think some of the most interesting elements there are the Drakus, obviously, is really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I think Bast and the idea of the Fey Courts is super interesting. The Cathay is mind-boggling and terrifying and is, like, world-breaking, and you don't know what to do with that. You haven't encountered the Cathay yet, have you?
No, I have not.
Yeah, that's a trip.
Interesting.
You don't even know, like, even I, who've read the Wise Man's Fear 5 times, you don't know what it is. You just know it essentially is like the omen of death. And they say in the books, whenever the Cathay interferes, you know only sorrow and terror are going to follow, no matter what it touches, whether it seems like it's good, whether it seems like it's bad. When the Cathay shows up and intervenes, worlds begin to end. And so it's just like the end all be all big baddie that everyone is terrified of and even rarely speak his name. Like, it's that level of maniacal. And so it's just I think that part of Rothfuss's world, the idea of the Fae and how that intertwines. I'm not going to go into everywhere, because you definitely do spend a decent amount of time with the Fae in book 2. But it definitely is a really interesting part of his universe. And I think I actually find the Fae more interesting than some of the things that are happening in the regular mortal world.
Mm.
What about you? What are some of your favorites?
Oh, man. If I had to pick specific magical creatures, I don't know why this is, but there's something that's always drawn me towards the ocean in terms of mythological creatures. So I really like merfolk. It's actually, honestly, a big part of why Orcadian mythology got its hooks into me so quickly, is because I discovered, like, this one thing that's very specific to Orcadian mythology. And just started following that trail out, and then suddenly I'm just immersed in all of this oceanic-based mythology, which makes sense for a chain of islands. And I don't know what that is. And it's, you know, a part of it could be that I come from South Dakota, you know, a little landlocked South Dakota, about as far away from an ocean as you can get. But I don't know. I think I've always just loved the water. Like, even as a kid, like, I love to go swimming. I love to be at the lake. But it also terrifies me. Like, I remember... And this is such a goofy thing, and I'm almost ashamed to admit it because it's so silly. But I remember when I was a kid, I watched the Goofy movie, okay?
Okay.
And there is a short little, like, one of the montage-y scenes in that movie where Goofy has his toes in the water and, like, a piranha-type thing, like, yep, bites his toe, right? Like, you know what I'm talking about, right?
I know exactly what you're talking about.
Something about that has like just stuck with me for the longest time as a kid. And I was so afraid of fish. Like, I just had this issue with fish. Like, maybe I shouldn't say afraid, more like I just did not want to be near them, especially if I were like swimming at the lake or something like that. I was just like so worried that a fish was going to come up and bite my toes.
Can I derail you there for a second?
Go for it. So I'm derailing myself.
So there, I remember some of my Boy Scouts friends from back in the day. There is a story that I don't remember. I can't remember names, but they knew of a guy who had been out in his boat in the middle of the lake with his feet in the water,
mm-hmm,
had a muskie bite his foot and try to take him under. And he ended up landing the muskie. It was like a state record level muskie. Got it in, got to the shore, and was getting patched up by EMTs. And then the DNR comes by and gives him a ticket for improper fishing.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah, I think it was called like illegal baiting or something.
Wow. Oh, I appreciate that story on so many levels, not the least of which is it's very validating to know that.
I can think of, like, another fun musky story from the Boy Scout camp I used to go to growing up. I remember they found a musky after the winter. It washed up as part of the winter kill, but it was on the shore, and it was, like, relatively fresh. And so they started looking at it, and it wasn't the water that killed it. It choked on a duck. It had inhaled a duck and died.
Wow.
Yeah, it was massive.
That's insane.
It might have even been a loon. Like, it might have even been a loon.
Sure. Oh, my gosh. All right. No, I appreciate that. Those stories make me feel so much better
there
about myself
big,
and my childhood fears
fish
now.
Out there, folks. If you don't know,
right?
If you don't know what a muskie looks like, the full taxonomical title is a muskie lunge. But go look them up. I'll drop a picture of a muskie in the show notes, and you will see how big and kind of scary these fish are. They're really cool.
Yeah.
But they are also scary. So, Kyle, I am further giving you confidence and backing you because your fears in this manner are justified.
All right. That's excellent. That's wonderful. Okay. I feel so much better now. But, yeah. And so, beyond that, I don't really know what it is that draws me so much to the water. But like merfolk, like I said, there's something about that I really, really enjoy. That's why one of my absolute favorite characters who I haven't played a whole lot, was a character that I introduced in our friend Celia's game.
Yep.
That we've talked about several times, that was very short lived, but, his name is Gitsune, and he is, a fish person, a merfolk. It was Undine, I think, in Pathfinder, which was the original, you know, setup I had, but I converted him to a Triton Warlock for 5e, And he just, like, everything about him makes me happy. I want to play him so bad, but I need the right context to play him. I just, something about that, it has always been compelling to me. And I love, like, you know, talk about, like, krakens and octopuses or octopi. Things like that have always been really interesting to me. I don't know. The ability to live under the ocean. Like, if I were to pick a place on Earth to just, like, randomly be able to, like, I would love to just be a merfolk for a while. It would be so much fun. So, I would have to say just about anything with points of contact with the water is interesting to me. And there's not a lot of that in a lot of the fantasy that I've read, necessarily. Okay. There's a lot of it in the mythology that I've read, but, like, Lord of the Rings, you really don't deal with it at all. Even Chronicles of Narnia, you really don't deal with it much. There's Voyage of the Dawn Treader, but they don't, if I remember right, don't really... They might encounter some merfolk, but it's not very much of a thing.
Yeah, I'm struggling to remember. It's been a long time since I read Dawn Treader.
Yeah, and you have the merfolk in Harry Potter... which play a little bit more of a role in Goblet of Fire. But beyond that, I don't know. It's just not something you see a lot of. You see a lot of it in D&D as far as the, like, shipwreck trope and the, you know, fighting a kraken or, you know, getting raided by merfolk. I think that's part of what has me kind of hooked on the current season of Critical Role, although I'm like 5 episodes behind right now. It's so bad.
Shame.
I know. Again, this Ravnica thing has just got me totally locked down.
There's even
in
a podcast
magic.
Form, Kyle.
I know. But that's the thing, is, like, I could listen to it on a podcast, but I enjoy it so much more when I can see their faces and know how they're reacting.
Sure. I understand that.
And also, I totally zone out during the fights if I don't have a map in front of me that I can look at and have some idea of what's going on. Yeah. And then I always, like, I hit a point where, like, something cool happens and I'm like, crap, what was happening? What was happening? Rewind. And then I rewind for like 20 minutes because I'm so lost on the context. I don't even know why the fight's happening anymore. So, yeah. Anyway, so oceans and stuff. That's a big one. Oh, what? I don't know that I have another one, but I should probably stop talking because I've been talking a lot again.
You're totally fine. I think I'm trying to sort out. Like, the major question I'm trying to sort out is, why do we keep coming back to certain creatures? So, like, why do certain creatures hold more, cultural weight is the way that it's coming out, but it doesn't seem to be.
Sure.
That's not necessarily a thing. So, like, why do we keep coming back to creatures like dragons?
Right.
That would
be the big one.
Why is the djinn such a prevalent figure in a lot of fantastical history? Like, I mean, mm-hmm. genies, like, subtract Aladdin out of this, because, I mean, like, you've got Jafar and you've got genie, and that's about your two instances,
right.
Two opposite sides of what a genie could be. But, I mean, you got them as an example. Like, there are certain, not necessarily tropey characters, but there's certain staple tent pole types of fantastical creatures that we keep coming back to. So I think the easiest one for us to riff on is kind of where we were going earlier, is like the dragon. Like, why do we keep coming back to that?
Mm-hmm.
And especially in different alternate ways, kind of like what I was saying, that you've got sentient versions, you've got just kind of reactionary dragons, because even in Skyrim, like, some of the dragons have shot, like, there's even a hierarchy within the dragons in Skyrim.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that there's basically your simple mindless ones, and then there's your super, super smart ones.
Right. Yeah, that is interesting, too, to look at. Okay, on the one hand, of course, game design is a thing, so for all practical intents and purposes, it's hard to have dragons actually roaming the map, because there's only so much a processor can handle. But you do really have, like, what makes Alduin so different from all the other dragons, and you do have that hierarchy where, you know, some of the dragons seem more inclined to engage with you. You deal with, oh, I'm forgetting his name and it's going to drive me nuts. It's the dragon that you trap in Dragon's Reach. Okay, you got Alduin, you've got Parthenax, you've got Soluknir, which is another really cool one. Gosh, what is his name? Anyway, the dragon that you trap in Dragon's Reach, who actually gives you the ride to... oh man, I haven't played Skyrim recently. Who am I? What is my life? I have no context for my identity, having not played Skyrim in this long. Just kidding. That would be really unhealthy. Anyway, so that dragon.
Sure.
Is interesting, just because, again, he's subservient to Alduin, but he also, like, once you best him, he's kind of like, all right, I'll go with, you know, whatever you want to do. The other dragons are kind of getting fidgety about Alduin's rule anyway, so maybe it's time for him to, you know, get taken down a notch or all the notches. Yeah, and I don't know. I mean, I think using Rothfuss as an example, I think that's one of the things he does so well is turn convention on its head in a way that's still very interesting, you know, with the Dracus being like, I'm not actually a mythological creature per se. So I don't know what it is that keeps us coming back to that necessarily, but it remains compelling all the same.
Yeah, I think for me, what's interesting in some of the ways that we see this kind of play out is that, like, one of the examples I go to is that I think of a little bit is Mushu from Mulan, and how he's kind of funny and he's kind of more of a guide than he is actually like applicable ragey dragon. Like,
right,
he's a tiny dragon, so he can't do too much, but he provides counsel and wisdom. And then you've got the Dracus, who is just a giant lumbering beast that eats trees and just exists and has existed for forever and basically just aren't hardly ever seen. And whenever people think that they see them, they apply all this mythical lore from the world, say, oh, it's a dragon, run, they're going to eat us. And he's just kind of lumbering around going, oh, I'm going to eat trees. But I think it's something that it's worth, I don't know, it's worth thinking about and exploring a little bit, because it's one of those things that in trying to think through why we keep using them. Is it that they reflect? Is it that they're just the symbology of them is evil and daunting, or is uncertain in nature, or is there something about the actual that they're just cool? Like, what do you think on that?
I think I want to do more research is the shortest and best answer I can give you there, because it is, you know, going back to my stomping ground. This is where I love Joseph Campbell so much, and the whole idea of comparative mythology and looking at why is it that dragons pop up everywhere, right? And how much of that, like, how many actual points of origin can we trace, and how similar are those points of origin? Or are we talking about just a singular idea having originated somewhere and it's just managed to be very voracious in the way that it's spread? And I don't know enough about, you know, when talking about dragons specifically, but that is one of those topics that I think makes for a great subject matter for comparative mythology to look at and say, where did it originate? And even, you know, just to give an example of a way that this happens in a different way, or a different context, looking back at Orcadian mythology, that has a very strong Norse influence because it's not far away from Norway and the what is the name for that collection of Norway, Finland, Sweden?
The Norse Isles? Like,
I don't know what word I'm looking for, okay?
I don't either.
I don't, yeah. Anyway, a lot of Norse mythology it has influenced the way Orcadian mythology developed. And I'm wondering how much of that is true for so many of these other traditions. And again, dragons specifically, to know, again, did it just spread from somewhere, or has it cropped up in two or three different unique places, and why? You know, if two or three cultures a world apart have created this essentially the same thing, the same kind of idea, well, on the one hand, it contributes back to Joseph Campbell's theory about how these ideas, it's a very Jungian idea, but these archetypal ideas are just embedded within the human psyche, but also leads me kind of back to that point. And again, guys, I'm not some crazy guy who's out there like conspiracy theorist, dragons exist, but it's like, but what is that though? Why do we latch onto it? And I'm inclined to just let that mystery sit to some extent too.
Listeners, what do you think? We want to hear your thoughts. Yes. MinMaxPod@gmail.com, MinMaxPod at all the socials, except Reddit, where we are MinMaxPodcast, 773-789-9369 on the voicemail number. I am at Alan H. Bowers on Twitter. Kyle is at Stainbrook Kyle. I think it's pretty.
It is so hard to say backwards. I
know,
get it. Again,
I for some reason, I want to go K.R. Stainbrook. I'm like, that's not right. Like, that is right, but it's not
is
right.
Semi-valid, yeah. It's where I tried to go with it, but that one wasn't available either. So, I don't know, all these other Stainbrooks out there that detached from my family, as far as I know. I don't know. Anyway.
Still missed Canebrook.
Yeah. You could just go to legally change it. It'd probably be easier.
But we want to hear what you guys think, because we're a little stumped. Like, we're trying to think through why we feel like these things come up. But why do you guys think dragons, like, why do you think certain mythological things keep coming back around? Send us an email. Leave us a voicemail. We'd love to hear your feedback. And with that, we'll see you guys next week.
Bye.
See you later. Don't get eaten.